It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll find out why elections in Wisconsin ranked near the top in a new national report. We'll talk with a guest about what we might be doing right and what he thinks the state could still improve on.
First, the legalization of marijuana is making headlines as states around the country, even counties within Wisconsin, vote on it. Our next guest is a public health historian who's taking a look back at how our society's views of drugs, alcohol, and tobacco have changed over time.
Virginia Barrage is with us now. She's the author of the new book, Demons, Our Changing Attitudes to Alcohol, Tobacco, and Drugs. She's a professor of history and director of the Center for History and Public Health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine at the University of London. Virginia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, I think a lot of us, whenever and wherever we live, have an assumption that the laws we have related to things like alcohol, tobacco, and drugs are based on how inherently harmful those substances are. As you write, it's a lot more than that. It's a lot more about what we think about those things. Can you talk about that a little?
Yes. I mean, in the book, I talk about how those substances, alcohol, opium, tobacco, once occupied almost like a common culture of use, where their use was acceptable in society. And the reason they've moved apart is for reasons other than the simple dangers of the substances themselves. There are a whole host of other issues which have impacted on them. The impact of technology and technical change, things like the development of the Bonsack machine, which made mass production of cigarettes possible by comparison with the development of the hypodermic syringe, which made a much more medical response to drugs the normal way. The different role of professional groupings, social movements, and also the role of fear. Who's using those substances and what sort of groups in society they're connected with. So all of those issues have had an impact on the substances in a different way.
Let's follow the story of opium a little bit. You write, mainly focusing on Britain, but it was true here in the United States, that in the 19th century and a little bit beyond, opium was pretty widely available in things like patent medicines and syrups and this and that. How widespread was just everyday opium usage?
Well, I think it was everyday opium use because you have to think back to a time when, you know, most people weren't going to their doctor, their physician. They didn't have the money probably to do that, or a physician wasn't available. So most of the treatment would have been self-medication in one form or another. There wasn't the knowledge of specific disease that developed later on. And so opium was a kind of cure-all for everything. You know, it dealt with headaches, it dealt with cholera, it dealt with you name it. It was something that everyone had in their medicine cabinet at the time.
What were some of the earliest concerns with hazards of opium in that sort of daily usage?
Well, I think people were concerned about the drug being adulterated, not being very pure. Lots of things were added to it. You never knew quite what standard you were getting when you bought it over the counter, and that made it very uncertain in the action that it would have. So lots of reports of opium overdoses, opium poisoning. So that was one quite big problem.
So that patent medicine bottle here might have a low dose, and the one right next to it with the same label might have an overdose in it.
Overdose, yes. Yeah, there was no kind of standardization. I mean, the other thing that people were concerned about was the dosing of children. Opium being used to keep children quiet, and there were lots of children's quietness, things like Godfrey's cordial, streets, infant quietness, things like with these sorts of names, were on the market at the time. And it was kind of the norm to give these to children. And there was a lot of concern about that, too.
And you mentioned the rise of fear and drugs being associated with particular groups. You write about the rise of the reality and more so the concept of the opium den run especially by Chinese people in London. It's almost like it's a trope that keeps coming up in literature again and again.
Yeah, I think, you know, if a substance is used by somebody who isn't you or me, you know, who's different in some way, or somebody who seems to be kind of deviant in some sort of way, is perceived in that way by commentators, then it's much easier to bring it under rigorous control. And that's what happened in relation to Chinese use, which was really blown out of all proportion, I think. People who watched the Chinese smoking, who knew something about the culture, said, well, this is really just like the Chinese equivalent of a social club. But the way it was portrayed in literature and in the sort of weekly magazines of the time made it seem something much more threatening and dangerous.
And that's a theme that keeps coming up again and again, whether it's Chinese people in London with opium, immigrants in the United States with alcohol, marijuana for a long time associated with African Americans, often urban decay type settings. Why is this the thing that keeps turning us toward banning substances, toward prohibition of various drugs?
Well, I think it's if a substance is associated with a kind of, you know, a group that's seen as different in society, then people are somewhat fearful of it. Also, I think there's always a fear that that group is going to somehow infect the rest of society. And that was one of the concerns in Victorian Britain, that lower class use, whatever sort it was going to undermine the whole of society. It was going to undermine respectable society as well.
And when does that start to translate from a concern, a public concern, moral concern, into laws? And we can come up pretty close to the present day with the crack cocaine epidemic here in the United States, again associated with African Americans in the public eye, and again leading to laws that targeted drugs African Americans used more than ones everybody else used.
Yes. Well, I guess, you know, the first kind of restrictions that were put on the statute book were restrictions under the pharmacy laws, which restricted drugs so that they could only be sold by pharmacists. They couldn't just be sold over the counter by any corner shop. So they had to be sold by a professional person, a pharmacist. And then restriction increased during and after the First World War. A whole system of international legal control of drugs was set up. It had been on the cards before the First World War, but it really only came into operation as an international system after that war. And it was under that system that America put into operation, for example, the Harrison Act, which was first passed in 1914, which served to very severely restrict the use of opiates.
Why does a society decide to ban, say, opium and other drugs that are now illegal and not things like alcohol and tobacco? Is there something inherent in alcohol or tobacco, or is it something else?
Well, I guess alcohol and tobacco originally were part of that same, you know, kind of mainstream culture that also had opium as part of it. But the sort of issues that I talk about in the book impacted differently on alcohol, for example, and also on tobacco as well. For example, the role of technology and technical change. With alcohol, that brought the possibility of mass production, and the same was true of tobacco with the coming of the Bonsack machine and the mass production of cigarettes. So with alcohol, you got a kind of mass culture of use, whereas with the opiates, it was a much more medicalized and restricted culture. And certainly during the First World War, although there was restriction, there was never a subsequent system of international control of alcohol. Obviously, in America, you had prohibition, but prohibition was relatively short-lived. It didn't last long as a countrywide system.
We're talking to author Virginia Berridge about her new book, Demons, Our Changing Attitudes to Alcohol, Tobacco, and Drugs. And we want to hear from you on this. How have you seen attitudes towards various drugs, alcohol, tobacco, change in the course of your lifetime? Why do you think some substances are more socially and legally acceptable than others? Do you see maybe some of the ones that are now illegal becoming legal in the near future? Some of the ones that are currently legal being more regulated? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or shoot us an email at talk@WPR.org. We continue our discussion now about how attitudes change over time toward things like alcohol, tobacco, and the long list of drugs that are illegal currently, opium, marijuana, cocaine, and others, how they change through history. Our guest is author Virginia Berridge. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Call in now and tell us how you've seen attitudes toward drugs, alcohol, and tobacco change in your lifetime. Why do you think some things are more socially acceptable than others? Why are some legal, some illegal? Why do attitudes change? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Virginia, speaking of changing attitudes, not long ago in the history of both of our countries, smoking was very common. Indoor smoking, taken for granted. Nobody really thought twice about it. Somebody at that time, would anybody have ever predicted that there'd come a day where we'd be banning smoking in all sorts of indoor locations?
No, I think back in the, say, the 1950s, when the connection between smoking and lung cancer was first being discussed, I think it would have been absolutely inconceivable that the position that we've got to today would have happened, because at the time smoking was so embedded in culture. The vast majority of people did smoke. It was just the norm. So there's been that huge cultural change, which has taken, you know, several decades to achieve.
And what had to change in public attitudes before there could start to be political action to start to restrict the use of tobacco?
Well, I think this is one of the things. Certainly the politicians in the UK were very concerned about restricting smoking because of the electoral implications that this might have. They were very worried because smokers were voters, and voters wouldn't be too happy about being restricted in something which was one of their main pleasures in life. So this was a lot of what the debate focused on in the 1950s and the 1960s. And it was only when smoking began to become less central in society that politicians, I think, were willing to shift their stance slightly.
And that's interesting. That's going from a legal substance to regulated. On the other hand, politicians can be worried if they start rethinking drugs that are currently illegal. In fact, you start by telling the story of a researcher, a government researcher, who lost his job ultimately because of comparing the harms and not some people not liking what they found. Can you tell us that story?
Oh, well, this was David Nutt, who was chair of the main British government's advisory committee on drugs, the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs. And he and some colleagues got together and developed a table of the actual harms of substances as opposed to the ways in which they're legally restricted. And of course, alcohol and tobacco came up much higher than some of the illicit drugs. And he then gave a talk which compared the dangers of horse riding with the dangers of taking ecstasy, and it was called ecstasy, and that was just going a bit too far, I think, and he lost his job as the chair of that committee. But this call for a kind of more rational response to the way substances are categorized and regulated has reverberated. It's been much discussed in the UK, and it's one of the reasons that I decided to write the book, because I wanted to argue that, in fact, those substances had been regulated according to particular historic reasons rather than in any kind of rational sort of way.
We'll bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We've got Joe with us in Spring Valley. Joe, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I want to comment on the use of opiates and the dangers of them. I started using opiates from a simple dental trip, and due to the dentist not being able to see me, he kept me on the painkillers. My body became addicted to them, very addicted to them. He then cut me off them. I started doctor shopping, and then that began a long, hard road of drug seeking and eventually turning to heroin. And lost several friends from overdoses. I lost my sister, Tammy, from a drug overdose to heroin. And, you know, there's a lot of young people now using heroin. And I just want to say to people out there that there's other alternatives to this. And, you know, I have grave concerns about the use of opiates.
All right, Joe. I want to bring our guest on this, but I'm very sorry for your losses, Joe, and good luck to you in dealing with this. Virginia, he brings up. I mean, the opiates are a very strange category. They're illegal in a way, but they're also available in prescription form. How are societies trying to juggle that difficult balancing act?
Well, I guess you know that's something that they've managed over a long period because. Certainly in the UK, heroin has retained its use as a very effective painkiller used to alleviate the pain of terminal cancer and so on. So it's had that medical usage, but it's also had that illicit usage as well. There have been attempts to ban heroin altogether for medical use in the past, but that's certainly not happened in the UK. So, yeah, that's a difficult balance to maintain. Sometimes one spills over into the other.
And talking about drugs in the language of addiction or being victimized by drugs, that's fairly new, isn't it?
Yes. Certainly back in the 19th century, people didn't talk about, you know, disease or addiction. They talked about somebody having a bad habit, maybe, but not in the way we use the term habit today.
Like spitting on the sidewalk is a bad habit or something
like that. Yes, yes. It's like, you know, doing something that you shouldn't do, but, you know, it was okay, you know, not too bad. And the idea of treating somebody, actually giving them treatment, was also something that wasn't normal. You know, it wasn't the automatic kind of response to somebody who had this habit. And it was only really towards the end of the 19th century that it became much more normal to talk about disease. People talked about inebriety, which was the disease of either alcohol or drug use. They talked about morphinomania or morphinism. And gradually, a more kind of stable terminology developed. People started to talk later on about alcoholism, and they started to talk about addiction when they meant illicit drug use. But certainly, really, until the early years of the 20th century, it wasn't the normal thing to talk about disease and treatment, and it was really quite difficult to establish any kind of system, any kind of regular system, where people did actually access treatment.
Well, you end your book venturing into dangerous territory for a historian, the future. You paint a couple possible paths we might take when it comes to the drugs we're talking about. What are those paths?
Well, one of the things I talk about is the way the substances, they don't kind of stop in the position which they've arrived at. I mean, history is constantly happening and evolving. And so some of the boundaries around substances have been changing in recent times. For example, the changes around cannabis, marijuana, the medicalization of cannabis, the medical uses of some drugs that are illicit, and the kind of recreational use of other sorts of drugs like the cognition enhancers. So I just really point to a future where we could be living in a much more hedonistic society, where taking drugs and taking substances of all sorts is much more normal and acceptable. Or the other alternative is where we move to a much more restrictive and regulated society, where there's a harsher attitude towards taking those substances. And I point to, some trends seem to lead in one direction and some in another, and it's difficult to say exactly where we'll end up in the future.
Well, the history is still happening. Virginia, thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, thanks.
That's Virginia Berridge. She's the author of Demons, Our Changing Attitudes to Alcohol, Tobacco, and Drugs, and she's a professor at the University of London. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, from Latin and Greek to Russian and Japanese, the English language has been borrowing words for centuries. A language expert tells us why foreign words play such a big role.
First, Wisconsin's elections ranked third best in the nation in November 2012, according to the latest comprehensive study of U.S. elections by the Pew Center on the States.
The report took into account things like voter turnout and data reporting, which Wisconsin scored well on, but there are still some aspects to voting and voter registration where our next guest thinks the state can still do better.
Joining us now is Kevin Kennedy, director of the Wisconsin Government Accountability Board. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Well, as we mentioned, Wisconsin ranked number three in the nation on elections. What kind of things did we score well on that put us in that high ranking?
Well, obviously, voter turnout is one, which means we have a very engaged electorate, people who take their responsibility seriously. But, data collection, which really originates in our office, but is contributed to by all of our local election officials. And we have 1,852 municipal clerks that are actively involved in running those elections. So it's quite a chore, and that was probably one of our biggest areas of improvement. But it's also what gets the information that demonstrates what a good job is being done by state and local election officials.
So when we're talking about data collection and improving data collection, what do we mean in terms of elections?
Well, we try to measure how many absentee ballots are being issued. If their return is undeliverable, why? Probably the two areas where we scored the least were the large number of military ballots that were returned as undeliverable, which tells us that the list of voters that we have from the military isn't as good, and we have to find ways to make sure that we have a good, solid list of the people in the armed services and overseas voters to get that, but also providing services to people with disabilities. Wisconsin was pretty high in the people who said they did not participate because of a disability or illness of for themselves or a family member that kept them from participating in the polls. So we want to really refocus that kind of effort. But one thing that also is good for Wisconsin is on our website, we provide a series of voter information tools where you can look up your polling place, your status for registration. You can get a sample ballot. If you're one of the rare voters who gets issued a provisional ballot, you can track the status, whether it was counted. So Wisconsin scored well in all years that they've done this measurement on the type of information we make available to voters, which really, engages them and gets them to the polls, gets them participating because they know where to go and they know who they're going to vote for.
Let's key in on a couple of the areas you mentioned as having room for improvement. People with disabilities voting, I know the Americans with Disability Act, the Help America Vote Act, I think also mandated that states work to make voting places, polling stations more accessible. What do you think Wisconsin still needs to do to improve on that?
Well, it's really a question of working with the disability community to make sure they're aware of the alternative means of participating in the process. Because where we ranked low were the people who reported in surveys that because of a disability for them or a family member, that kept them from participating in the process. Wisconsin was lauded both in the Pew Report and in a recent report of the Presidential Commission on Election Administration for the work we do making the polling places accessible, assessing that and identifying areas for improvement. But it's clear that, this is a community that's often hard to reach out to. And so we want to make sure that we are working with individuals in the community and groups that serve them so that they have better access not only to the polls but to other means of voting, absentee voting.
So the accommodations are there. Part of the solution is just making sure people know that those accommodations are there.
That's right, because the measurement was really based on self-reporting. When we look at the work that goes into polling place accessibility, you know, that's one area that, separate from this, Wisconsin has been singled out for making a tremendous effort compared to other states.
And then for military absentee ballots, what would you like to see change to improve our rate there?
Well, we've taken some steps already to improve that. In a sense, we have an electronic delivery system, which really cuts down the time for military voters, and as well as people who are permanently overseas. They can apply for a ballot online. It gets sent to them electronically. They return it through the mail process. But it's really making sure that we are tracking them, that we, you know, when someone identifies themselves as a military elector, we single them out so that they can have access to this online ballot delivery system.
And speaking of online and voting, this report gave Wisconsin high marks for same-day voter registration, but they also suggested online voter registration, expanding that around the country. They're looking for. What do you think about that? Would it improve Wisconsin's elections, make it easier for people to register?
Absolutely. I think when we're talking about online registration, we're talking about something that's no longer cutting edge. We have 20 states that are doing this. It's a proven and effective technology that really facilitates participation by voters. So many people are active electronically. It makes sense to them to be able to register to vote electronically. We have the capabilities with our database and matching up against the Department of Transportation's driver's license and state ID databases to ensure security in the process. But it's so much simpler and much more cost-effective than filling out a piece of paper that's hard to read that then has to be entered into the system by someone who can make a mistake. You know, what we've learned from online registration, we did a study. It would save taxpayers across the state probably $1 million over a 10-year period. Most of that, the work of our local election clerks who would not be doing as much data entry, would not have to correct errors, would not have to struggle with the bad penmanship, or even the multiple forms that come in where someone, you know, in a voter registration drive gets hit three times and they're just like, they're tired of saying no, so they fill out another form. We, you know, our local clerks go through the process of entry and only to find out the person's already registered.
Now, a new state law advanced by the state legislature would limit early voting hours currently in Wisconsin. I won't ask you to get political here. I know your office can't weigh in on, you know, for or against, I don't think. But what impact do you think that might have on turnout and maybe on Wisconsin's future rankings on this kind of report?
Well, we'll have to see on the ranking, future rankings on that, because obviously the reason we score well is that Wisconsin and its election officials are geared to serving the voter. And that's really what elections are about. You know, we're giving the people of this country the opportunity to select their leaders. I mean, that's why we have a representative democracy. But, you know, we saw a reduction in absentee voting hours before when it was more than 3 weeks for in-person absentee voting down to just 2 weeks. And we had more people voting in that two-week period. I think the real challenge is in larger municipalities. It's handling the crowd. When we look at the elections this year, we won't have as many absentee voters in a gubernatorial election as we have in a presidential year, and we won't have quite the turnout. So we probably won't see as much of an impact this time. It'll really be in 2016, if the law is still in place at that point, that we'll see that really does force voters to plan, because they will have a limited time period. They will not have the weekends. Not many places were open much later than 7 o'clock at night anyway. You know, I think what we do is we try to focus the outreach here. They still can request a ballot by mail. For the fall elections, the ballots are available 47 days before the election. So that does provide some other alternatives for voters to participate in the process without going directly to the clerk's office.
At the outset, you mentioned a higher than average voter turnout in Wisconsin. We've got this high ranking on elections. Do we take Wisconsin seriously? Do we take pride in our election system in the state, do you think?
Oh, it's a definite source of pride. I think I talk to voters and election officials who are proud to be part of this state, part of that process. I know that the staff that works with me here at the Elections Board or at the Government Accountability Board takes great pride in being able to be recognized nationally and consistently for that process. And I know our local election officials do. And I've talked to a lot of voters who are happy they're living here with their opportunities to participate in the process. They usually have stories about frustrations they've encountered in other states.
We'll leave it there. Kevin, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That's Kevin Kennedy, director of the Wisconsin Government Accountability Board. From fork to government, tacos to taboos, the English language is packed with words that we've borrowed from other languages. Latin and Greek, French and German, Japanese and Tongan. We've been adding loan words for centuries.
Philip Durkin tells the story of these words in his new book, Borrowed Words, A History of Loan Words in English. He's deputy chief editor of the Oxford English Dictionary. Philip, welcome to the show.
Hello. Hello.
So we just heard a sampling of some of the loanwords that we've borrowed here in English. What is the biggest source of loanwords that we know of?
The biggest source numerically is Latin, and closely followed by French. And in fact, the numbers for Latin and French overlap, because quite a lot of words show some input from Latin and some input from French as well. So those absolutely top the numbers. If you're looking at a very big dictionary, like the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, or if you're looking at the average sort of collegiate-level dictionary as well, in the full list of words in the dictionary in your hand, then the majority of the words borrowed from other languages will come from Latin and French.
And that comes from what? Latin being the church language and then 1066 and all that when the Normans invaded England?
Yeah, precisely. And it's very interesting, actually, if you start to think about the words that are most frequent in modern English, if you look at, say, the 1,000 most frequent words in modern written English, if you look at a corpus of data, which is the sort of thing linguists do these days, then you find that, actually, in those 1,000 most frequent words, nearly half of them have been borrowed from Latin or French or a bit from both, and nearly all of those, by far the biggest proportion, came into English in the period between the Norman Conquest and about 1500, so the Middle English period, the medieval period. And that's a period when culture in England was, in an interesting way, trilingual, because there was very little official writing happening in English. Pretty much everybody had English as their first language, their language of the home, their mother tongue. But they would learn French at a very early stage and then acquire Latin through French. So French would be the first language learned at the sort of song schools, the first schools that people who were destined to become literate would attend. And then they would acquire Latin through the medium of French. And this is something that carried on until roughly the time of the Black Death. And this had an enormous impact on the way people wrote and the way people thought and the language that they used for official purposes. So about time I started to give you some examples, isn't it? So this is the period in which we find that words that are part of the everyday language today, like, say, age or arrive or defense or court, are coming into English from French. Some words from Latin like case or election or evidence, those words probably come partly from Latin, partly from French. And then a little bit later, we have words like agree, number, money, language, client, idea, individual, private. The sorts of words that we need to formulate pretty basic ideas and concepts in English today, which all came flooding into the language from French and Latin in that period.
As far as existing languages go, English has always seemed like a bit of a magpie to me. Is that right? Is English more likely to borrow than other languages?
I think with an awful lot of hedges and an awful lot of qualifications, basically, yes. It's very hard to make these comparisons between languages. You have to be very careful how you set the goalposts, what exactly you're going to compare. But the work that scholars have done trying to compare basic vocabulary across languages around the world, English tends to come out pretty high, not quite the highest, but higher than average in the amount of borrowing that's got through even into the everyday language, let alone the language of learning and science.
We've seen some countries make a conscious effort to preserve their language and its purity, and I'm thinking, I know France has done this on and off over the years. I don't know if there's been that kind of official effort ever in English. Has that helped maintain that inflow of loanwords?
Certainly, what you would call language purism, trying to protect the language from foreign borrowings, has rarely been very important in the history of English. But it's questionable how much of an impact that has for any language. In France, certainly, you have the Academy proposing words that should be used for new concepts, suggesting that you should be using, I think it's right to say, réseau rather than internet, or to say ordinateur rather than computer or computeur. But I think that in actual French use, the borrowed words are getting much more traction in that area. So it's a bit questionable how far that sort of language purism really has a big effect on the language use of real people.
Are there parts of society that are more likely to glom on to loanwords, maybe the scientific community, the culinary, the academic?
Yes, I think you've hit on three of the biggest ones there. The academic is interesting because I think that if you look at the numbers of new words coming into English from other languages compared with the numbers of new words being created within English, over the last couple of centuries, we do seem to be on something of a downward trend, actually, in borrowing. There are still many, many new words coming into English, and a lot depends on whose English you're talking about. So different contact situations around the world, different individuals will have a different set of loanwords in their language coming from other languages that they have contact with, that the culture they're living in has contact with. But still, there does seem to be a decline happening from the late 1800s through to the present day. And I think that has a lot to do with the changing language of learning, that if you look at scientific publication, technical publication in all sorts of areas in the 1800s through to the early 1900s, then French and German were really leading languages of publication. And you find that many scientists were coining their new words in French and in German, and they were getting borrowed from those languages into English and into other languages. And today, English is becoming much more the predominant language of scientific publication. But in fact, some of those words are words that you might not at first glance think of as being French or German. For instance, oxygen is a word that's formed from Greek elements that originate in the Greek language, but it was coined by French scientists in the late 1700s. And it was borrowed from French, oxygène, into English and into other European languages. Another example would be ozone, the name of the gas, which was borrowed from German into English and into other European languages because it was discovered by a German scientist who named it in German, but he named it using elements that originate in Greek. So its first element is from the ancient Greek verb ozdein, to smell, because ozone has a particularly sharp odor, and that gave rise to its name. But he coined it in German, and certainly in the Oxford English Dictionary, we would regard that actually as a German word borrowed into English.
I wonder if we could somehow magically strip out all the words English has borrowed over the years. Would we be able to have a conversation apart from maybe something about plowing crops and repelling Vikings?
It would be pretty difficult. You mentioned the Vikings there, did you?
Yes. They brought us some, didn't they?
Sorry?
The Vikings brought us some words, too?
They certainly did. And actually, quite small in number. But if you drill down to look at, say, the 100 most frequent words in modern English, then there's quite a number of words that came in from early Scandinavian, from the language of the Vikings that later developed into Norwegian, Danish, Swedish. So we have words like to get, to take, to give, like, or to want. And most amazingly of all, the pronoun they. So if we say we or you we're using words that go right back to the earliest origins of the English language. But if we use they, we're using a word that was borrowed into English from Scandinavian. The Anglo-Saxons said here, a word that isn't related for they, and they came in from the language of the Scandinavian Viking settlers in very close communication with Anglo-Saxons, and it slowly spread to become the usual word for they throughout all of English, which is quite amazing influence from another language, and that is really rare around the languages of the world, actually. Borrowing of pronouns and borrowing of core grammatical words is a really rare phenomenon.
Very interesting. Philip, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
That was Philip Durkin, Deputy Chief Editor of the Oxford English Dictionary. His new book is Borrowed Words, A History of Loanwords in English.